So we're going to be hearing from Duncan today. He's been a socialist for over a decade, he told me, and he's from the Brisbane branch of Socialist Alternative. So for people that haven't been to Socialist Alternative meetings before, there's going to be the speech and then there'll be plenty of time for discussion afterwards. So people should definitely have a think during the talk about points they might want to make in the discussion, any questions that they might want to ask. So yeah, take it away.
Thanks. So I think it's safe to say that most historians, as well as like general state propaganda around the First World War, see the collective sacrifice of a conflict as a birth of Australia as a unified nation. And I think we should say this is an absolute lie. And this talk, a lot of this talk will be reflecting upon exactly how much of a lie that is. By the end of the war, Australia was actually deeply divided, with poisonous racism against aliens, common currency, and hatred of disloyalists who had opposed conscription propagated by the press, government, and church. The ideas of the radical left were gaining popularity as strikes surged amongst a war-weary working class. And the 1919 Red Flag Riots in Brisbane were the result of the build-up of these tensions and divisions, practically an explosion of racist and right-wing vigilante violence, which at points seemed to threaten the Queensland Labor government itself. And so I'll be using a lot of the cartoons from the Worker newspaper, which was a very popular newspaper run by the Australian Workers' Union throughout this talk to illustrate some of these sort of what was seen to be the situation at the time from among the most popular working class publication. And this is just one of the ways they depicted. It might be hard to see the actual writing on the screen there, but basically the Tory press, Mr. Fat, other capitalists throwing sectarianism, division, and hatred amongst the majority of people. And I guess it's also worth mentioning that this history it's only thanks to the efforts of really dedicated radical historians, in particular, in the case of the Red Flag Riots, Raymond Evans, who's written a fantastic book, which we would definitely have copies of in our bookstall downstairs, which is entitled The Red Flag Riots. It was only published in 1988, which even actually discussed any of the context of these events and what they really, really showed. But yeah, I think that this the task of actually explaining some of this sort of history, you know, falls to the role of socialists to actually explain the true history of this country. So this atmosphere of suspicion and hostility was actually largely the product of the efforts of government to regiment society to the needs of the war, World War I. The War Precautions Act was the centrepiece of this effort by the federal government of Billy Hughes. Everyone should boo. under the Precautions Acts, as it came to be known, people charged with prejudicing recruitment to the military were given a 6-month jail sentence, which provided a huge net to sweep up leftists who were against the war. The Act also provided the basis for establishing concentration camps for enemy aliens, which primarily, of course, meant Germans, 7,000 of whom were interned over the course of the war, and the majority of those people were deported afterwards. They also were the powers that enabled the establishment of the Special Intelligence Bureau, which is the direct precursor to ASIO. The Acts legalised national censors based on military districts whose job was mainly to rifle through the mail of dissidents and leftists and to prevent the publication of anti-war or anti-conscription material. So very, very censorious period. And in the closing months of World War I, the War Precautions Act was used to criminalise the display of disloyal flags. First, the Irish Republican flag, and followed closely by the Red Flag. Breaking that law could see someone imprisoned for 6 months. And this reflected a conspiratorial and racist attitude amongst defenders of Australian capitalism, which saw social unrest as a subversive activity of left-wing foreigners. And it was actually pushed by government agents, in particular the censor, the Special Intelligence Bureau, and as reaching as high up as people like Hughes himself. The Red Flag Riots were a particularly horrible example of these ideas coming into practice when the wrath of the state was mobilised against Brisbane's Russian emigre community. So during the war, and this cartoon behind me is an example of what I'm about to talk about, the riots actively stoked divisions between the volunteer soldiers, keep in mind conscription was never implemented in Australia in World War I, and the rotters and the shirkers who refused to fight, who were called scum, if they advocated for peace and socialism and counterposed to the brave heroes seen above. who volunteered to fight. The state, in conjunction with the press, advanced intense moral pressure to pull Australian workers behind the war effort and to discredit the left and union movements. And this was very successful. Over the course of the war, some 38% of men between the age of 18 and 44 volunteered to fight. Many soldiers returning from the war began to assimilate these ideas into their understanding of the suffering that they had endured. During the earlier debates on conscription, so in 1916 and 1917, returned soldiers had attacked meetings of the left and unions, who were the main groups opposing the push for conscription. As the war reached an end, soldiers began to mobilise into right-wing organisations. The main one, or the most important one subsequently at the time, was the Returned Sailors and Soldiers Imperial League of Australia, which is now the RSL. Alongside these public organisations, efforts were afoot within the ruling class to establish secret paramilitaries. In May 1918, Herbert Brooks, a prominent industrialist and president of the Victorian Chamber of Manufacturers, so not exactly a poor person, met with the Special Intelligence Bureau and also the acting Prime Minister, seeking to establish an organisation to assist the forces of law and order against the threat of Bolshevik insurrection. And the people he met with included the Police Commissioner, the Queensland Police Commissioner, Frederick Urquhart, ostensibly in charge of upholding the law, and he welcomed Brooks' suggestion for what was going to be called the Australian Protective League, and he was actually slated, the Police Commissioner, to lead the group in New South Wales and Queensland. And while, you know, it might be surprising since he was a police commissioner that he would be in this position, we really shouldn't be surprised. He was actually in charge in an earlier period of his life of the Native Police in Queensland, directly responsible for massacres of Indigenous people, particularly the Kaltukunga people, more commonly known as the Kalkadoons around the Mount Isa region, and also led a cavalry charge against workers during the 1912 Brisbane General Strike. And so that's what he looked like around the period in which we're discussing. So discussions for the Australian Protective League did not progress past initial planning, but Brooks got the ball rolling. So, but the first sort of establishment of an actual organisation came about in early 1919 with a group called the United Loyalist Executive, later changed its name to the King and Empire Alliance. It was formed by a Dr. Ernest Sanford Jackson. He was a surgeon, educated at Geelong Grammar and Melbourne University. He had been a major in the war. And he was president as well of the Queensland Club, which is an extremely exclusive bourgeois social club, literally stands across the road from the Parliament in Brisbane. With his impeccable connections, Jackson's organisation brought together all the returned soldiers' organisations, the Orange Lodge, the Protestant League, the Royal Society of St George, and the Loyalty League, to claim a combined membership of 60,000 people by March of 1919. The ULE approached Urquhart for his involvement, and even though he felt he could not publicly involve himself, he felt no squeamishness about their goals of going beyond peaceful means if necessary. And as well, the censor's office, the people who were basically reading everyone's mail, were aware of the beginnings of right-wing paramilitaries, but brushed aside these reports, saying, all the more power to them. So these right-wing circles organised vigilante violence to attack the left, escalating in the lead-up to the Red Flag riots. In August of 1918, soldiers actually attempted to tear down the Red Flag flying above Trades Hall, which existed in Brisbane at the time, repulsed only by left-wing soldiers. In October, at the rural town of Hughenden in North Queensland, returned soldiers organised by the RSL and military intelligence, so directly organised by basically ASIO, it violently attacked workers' demonstrations, called to support a strike of female bar staff. Soldiers attempted to break up the celebrations of the first anniversary of the Russian Revolution in Brisbane, but they weren't successful. They were only a nuisance to the crowd of about 1,000 who attended. There was also violent bashings of IWW men, so the industrial workers of the world. Anyone who was on the left at this time was seen as being IWW. There were violent bashings of people associated with the IWW in Townsville and Dalby around the end of 1918. So this project of attacking the union movement on the left and the willingness to go beyond the strictures of the law, I think can be seen as an Australian variant of fascism which developed in parallel to the stirrings of the far right in Europe at the time. So that's the right, and they're all getting organised. And then on the side of the left, we see a lot of also going on as well. So in the aftermath of the defeated 1905 revolution in Russia, actually 2,000 Russian emigres took up residence in Queensland and 800 in Brisbane. These were largely refugees, victims of Tsarist repression, and therefore naturally found a home amongst Queensland's radical left. The founder of the Union of Russian Workers, which was essentially both a Russian community organization as well as a left-wing organization, was actually a Ukrainian Bolshevik called Artem Segeyev. He founded that organization in 1911. While he was in Brisbane until 1917, he immigrated back to Russia at the start of the February Revolution and was subsequently a member of the Bolshevik Central Committee and actually a leader of the October Insurrection. But not all the Russian emigres were Bolsheviks. Often they're sort of seen as Bolsheviks just because they were Russian, or obviously the right smeared them in that way. But actually, their leadership came from a very diverse political background, reflecting the diversity of the Russian revolutionary movement. But they were all radicalized by the October Revolution, and they were inspired by the Bolshevik success. So Artem's actual initial replacement as leader, and leader of the time of the Red Flag Riots, was this guy, Alexander Zuzenko. And he was actually an anarchist. And other prominent leaders of the Union of Russian Workers were Herman Bykov, who was a social revolutionary, and Peter Simonov, who became the consul of Soviet Union in Russia, appointed by Trotsky, but actually hadn't even come from a political background at all. So to further the cause of international revolution, the Union of Russian Workers set up an English language newspaper called Knowledge and Unity. And in reading the newspaper, you get the sense that they had very similar ideas about how socialist revolution could be achieved to the broader Australian left at the time. They grasped the significance of Soviets as a means for workers to control society, but they generally believed organising all workers into one big union was the means to get there. And obviously, these revolutionary Russians were a source of anguish for the censorship and for the right in society. So then there's the Queensland Union Movement. Well, they were largely united in opposition to the War Precautions Act. Even members of the more right-wing Australian Workers' Union were persecuted because they opposed conscription while they supported the war. And the banning of the red flag led to an active union campaign in Brisbane to repeal the act. While for the right-wing press, the red flag was identified as a symbol of anarchy, which you saw before. See?
Anarchy.
While it was identified as a symbol of anarchy and even devil worship, for the workers' movement, it was the universal symbol of the international working class, regardless of nationality. And protests across the country saw socialists defy the ban on the red flag, which thus became a potent symbol of the unjust crackdown on civil liberties that the War Precautions Act embodied. And this was particularly the case after the armistice that ended World War I, which was in November of 1918, and the War Precautions Act was maintained subsequently. So in early 1919, a Brisbane joint meeting of the Russian workers, the One Big Union Propaganda League, the Socialist Party, and most importantly, the peak union body, the Brisbane Industrial Council, decided to protest the War Precautions Act on January 26, which was not a day that had any significance at the time. So this is a good photo of that demonstration. About 1,500 people marched through Brisbane, and while they didn't actually have any technical red flags, their banners and what they were wearing was festooned in red in the form of sashes and ribbons. And speakers after the march ranged from Labour parliamentarians to members of the radical left who praised Trotsky and the Bolsheviks and raised three cheers for the revolution. So this march indicated the potential for a strong campaign against the various restrictions on civil rights from the War Precautions Act, which would bring in members of the union movement and the radical left. And so, of course, the state authorities were anxious to see it nipped in the bud. A few days after the demonstration, military intelligence, which was based out of Victoria Barracks in the Brisbane suburb of Peachey Terrace, tore apart the headquarters of the URW, searching for banners from the march. And Urquhart recommended to the federal government that the Russians, who cherished the intention to destroy the Constitution and were of an undesirable class, should be thrown into internment camps and deported. Urquhart's suggestions, obviously, were a reflection or were an augur, rather, of what was to come. So after the military raid on the Russians, the Brisbane Industrial Council seemed to be set on a course of further confrontation, passing a motion on March the 12th that at all future demonstrations, the red flag would be flown in direct defiance of the authorities. At the very same time, though, literally on the same day, the leadership of the Queensland Labor Party issued a manifesto entitled Solidarity or Disruption, which railed against the IWW, saying that their ideas were not a doctrine, not a program, not a movement, nor even a definite tendency, but simply a turbulent and fractious state of mind. So very, harsh. ALP leadership demanded that its constituent organisations and the unions work to drive out IWW supporters. So this is just the main figure within the ALP at the time. Premier was actually overseas, Ryan, everyone, TJ Ryan, maybe people might know of him, but Ted Theodore was the treasurer and acting premier at the time. They demanded that they drive out their IWW. This declaration of war upon the radical left by the ALP was actually a new step by the right in the workers' movement. As contradictory tendencies battled each other in the workers' movement, another joint demonstration of the left and unions was called for March 23rd, a demonstration which would be the spark for the most violent riots in Brisbane's history. So this march, which assembled on a Sunday afternoon outside of Trades Hall, was much smaller than the one in January, which really attested to the dampener that the Labor Party's denunciation of the left had put on the movement. Only about 400 people, as opposed to the 1,500 earlier, were there, and about half of them were Russians. The Industrial Council, which was still nominally the people organising this march, had received a permit from the Labor government only on the proviso that the marchers not fly any red flags, despite what they'd passed as a resolution only 9 days ago. When William Wright, the president of the Industrial Council, announced the conditions of the permit, he was shouted down by the demonstrators, particularly amongst the Russians. Zuzenko and Bykov, ignoring Wright, unfurled two large red flags and started the march. And about half a dozen police, who hadn't been prepared for this, tried to stop the crowd unsuccessfully. The demonstrators singing Solidarity Forever marched to the Domain, which is where QT Gardens Point campus is now, where a succession of speakers lambasted the War Precautions Act, speaking about the importance of the red flag, including Monty Miller, who was an ancient veteran of the workers' movement who participated in the Eureka Stockade. And when the demonstration started to break up at around 5:30 p.m., though, the forces of the right had already begun to mobilise. And this map will make sense once I start to explain what's going on. So while the precise series of events is unknown, by the time that the weekly speak out, so after 5:30, was happening of the one big union propaganda league, starting in North Quay. So North Quay is on the north of the Victoria Bridge, just there. That's now the location of what's called Brisbane Square, between the Brisbane City Council Library and the Treasury Building. By the time of that speak out, a huge force of returned soldiers had mobilised. As soon as the first speaker got onto the platform, hundreds of them rushed the stage with the cry, "Let's clear this scum out of Brisbane." And they lifted the huge wooden speaker's platform, which they would address the crowds, and threw it into the river. So Zuzenko, who was at the time was speaking, extricated himself from the crowd and sprinted across Victoria Bridge to warn the rest of his comrades, which were at the Russian Club Rooms, which is here. So Victoria Bridge is running down to warn them. Bykov was not so lucky. He was struck multiple times by clubs and stabbed, and he was only saved from being thrown into the river by the last-minute intervention of a policeman. So having smashed up this meeting, the soldiers massed in heavier numbers. Officers of the military intelligence in the crowd later reported to their masters, so obviously they weren't trying to do anything to stop this, they reported to their masters that the group of about 2,000 strong resolved to attack the Bolshevik headquarters, the Russian Club Rooms, across the river and to burn it down. In the meantime, Zuzenko, having run across the bridge, down the streets, he'd reached the Russian workers' headquarters and rallied about a dozen defenders. And at least some of them, we don't know exactly how many, had firearms. So by the time the mob of soldiers neared the club rooms, three shots rang out above the heads of the attackers, which caused them to fall back in panic. It was only now that the police intervened to try to stop the riot, warning the soldiers that an attack on the club rooms would result in many soldiers being shot. And then army officers addressed the crowd saying, well, they should regroup and return the next day with arms from the barracks. A resolution was passed to the effect that tomorrow would determine who owns Australia, Australians or the Bolsheviks. So the headlines of the capitalist press the following morning dripped with outrage and bloodlust. They depicted the successful Red Flag March as a Bolshevik takeover, where not only were police assaulted, but the ideals of Australia trampled. The defence of the clubrooms by the Russians from the murderous mob was spoken of as if Bolsheviks had fired on soldiers without warning. So, as you can see, police constables defied, you know, shots fired at soldiers, as if the armed Russians were in any way threatening elements. So that night, the papers actually publicised a rally to basically continue what was the pogrom that started the previous night. So meeting on the northern side of the Victoria Bridge in North Quay, like they had the night before, the demonstration was huge. Between 7,000 and 8,000 milled around, filled with anticipation. And then someone swings a large Australian flag and the mob heads off with its violent purpose across the bridge. The soldiers are singing Australia Will Be There, a song composed a few years earlier during World War I and often sung by soldiers on the march. Many are actually carrying firearms. The thronging mass has a clear target, the meeting hall of the Russians, which is located on Merivale Street. Now that's in the opposite of the convention centre, people from North Brisbane. As they cross the river, the soldiers are yelling, hang them, burn their meeting place down, and down with the Bolsheviks. But as the marchers near the Russian hall, to their surprise, and probably to the surprise of everyone listening here, they find about 50 police blocking their path, lined in two rows with bayonets fixed on their rifles across the road. And this image, which was the title image, is from the Police Union Journal of June 1919, depicting this event. So it's obviously quite puzzling that the police were there. The official explanation was that they sought to prevent the soldiers, obviously, from rampaging around, causing a firestorm and destroying property. But letters from by police, intercepted by the censor, indicate it might also have been because the property that the Russian club rooms were in were owned by a Labour minister. So whatever the reason, at the side of the armed police, the huge mass angrily demanded passage. But the police remained firm, and so bricks, bottles and other projectiles are being thrown from the crowd, while the sheer numbers of people are starting to push the front ranks of the soldiers into the police. With the situation apparently ready to explode, 10 mounted police, without warning, charge into the rear of the soldiers with batons flailing. Horses trample over the surprised crowd, which scatters in panic. But the mob was out for blood, and the police attack turns what was already a riotous mob into a pitched battle. In the first attack by the mounted police, a horse and its rider were already knocked to the ground by a stone throw. And then they grab whatever's to hand, and they surge at the police. Sub-Inspector McNeil had his peak caps, you can see their peak caps, cleaved in half by a blow from a metal bar and was knocked unconscious, narrowly avoiding death. Sergeant Ferguson suffered a fractured skull from a railway spike, and Police Magistrate Archdall, who we'll see later, and Police Commissioner Urquhart both suffered bayonet wounds from their own men during the frenzied melee. So you can see the very large bayonets. Where was my spot here? The battle actually lasted for about 2 hours until police allowed a small delegation of soldiers past their lines to inspect the Russian hall, which had been totally devastated by a hail of projectiles as well as homemade bombs by the soldiers. So satisfied that the hall was in ruins and that no Russians were inside, the riot finally abated. The casualties from the riot were grossly underreported by the capitalist press, who were eager to justify the soldiers, but also because fewer of the soldiers appear to have presented themselves to hospital. So we know that 19 of the police were wounded, including 7 of the 10 mounted officers, many of whom suffered bullet wounds. So it's quite remarkable that nobody was killed. And on the rioters' side, at least 100, according to police estimations, must have been stabbed by bayonets. And one of the police horses was shot 9 times and had to be put down. The response of the Labor government the next day, under, remember, Ted Theodore, acting premier, was to condemn the violence of the riots, but also to assure the soldiers that no sympathy was felt for the Russians. In fact, he volunteered that he would personally investigate claims that Russians held jobs in the public service. So this public face of support, essentially, for this riot, though masked some disquiet among the Labour government, and particularly the union movements, who were concerned that the riot sought to attack not just revolutionaries, but the entire Labour movement. Even Police Commissioner Urquhart, so it obviously backed basically the organisation of these paramilitaries, seemed to have had a momentary change of heart after suffering his deep stab wound the night before. From his hospital bed, he wrote to the Premier that he had received reports that the soldiers planned to assault the police headquarters at Roma Street and the offices of the Labour Party newspaper, The Daily Standard. So he was essentially concerned that there was a right-wing insurrection on the way. And Urquhart urged the Premier to put the military on alert, which probably wouldn't have done anything, but also to enrol special constables to assist the police. Theodore and Urquhart, though, quickly decided against such action. They met with trade union officials, including Bob Carroll of the Engineers Union, who had actually spoken at the Red Flag March, and they urged the Premier to recreate the Labour Volunteer Army, which had been born during the conscription campaign, as a militia of unionists to defend the meetings of the conscription campaign against returned soldiers. The military commandant, Brigadier General Irving, was very alarmed by rumours that this army would be refounded, but he was told by Theodore and Urquhart that they had ruled out this action because they were suspicious of the source it would be drawn from, which is to say the ranks of organised workers. It's really noteworthy, I think, though, that a plan to form a workers' militia was actually entertained by a reformist party at all. For Urquhart's part, it seems that while he was entirely in sympathy with the objectives of the soldiers, as we heard, he wanted to deport the Russians, he would not agree with their path of challenging the established authorities, even when Labour was in government. And the decision of the state government to rebuff the union leaders, calling for a defence of the left, proved fateful. On one hand, it meant that the mobilisations of the far right were themselves largely contained to calling upon the government to act to punish the Bolsheviks, rather than an insurrection against Labour. On the other hand, Theodore eagerly threw the radical left to the wolves to prove Labour's loyalty to the Empire. And so the subsequent days following this riot were filled with menace and ongoing threats of far-right violence. Night after night, thousands of returned soldiers met in what is now King George Square to hear bloodthirsty speeches from military officers and members of the respectable establishment. And here's another one of them. Major Harold Taylor, the president of the Brisbane RSL, chaired those demonstrations, and he spoke about eradicating the microbe of Bolshevism before it could infect the rest of the country. Taylor, typical blue-blooded aristocrat, had attended Brisbane Boys College, served as an agent of the censorship, and later in life would be elected Liberal MP for the upper-class suburb of Hamilton, which is today the electorate of Clayfield. Thomas Byrne, a retail multimillionaire who set up the UQ Law School, spoke at one of these demonstrations to say that Bolsheviks should be bayoneted on the spot, while others called on the government to deport all left-wingers, whether Russian or not. The night after the initial attack on the police outside the Russian club, soldiers attacked the offices of the Daily Standard, this is the Labour Party's newspaper, because it had dared to report on their riot of the night before as shameful. The windows of the building were smashed up and passers-by manhandled. Another mob of soldiers marched across the river to attack Russian homes in South Brisbane, but were met there by residents armed with shotguns and dynamite and warned off by the police. The Labour government was only too happy to oblige the federal authorities' swift instructions to prosecute the Red Flag marches, while essentially ignoring the rioters who attacked police the following night. The morning before the riot, Urquhart had telegrammed military authorities with a list of bearers of the Red Flag. So by the end of the week, 21 people were arrested and 16 were charged for breaching the War Precautions Act, and only two of those people were people who participated in the riot. Most of the charges laid were against Russians and members of the One Big Union Propaganda League. Separately to the charges regarding the Red Flag March, 8 prominent Russian leftists were arrested by the military and imprisoned in Victoria Barracks, which included Zizenko, in preparation for their deportation, and they weren't charged with anything. Alongside the arrests, the wrecked Russian club rooms, which remember had been bombed and smashed to pieces, were permanently closed 3 days after the riot by military intelligence, and Russians were hounded from their jobs and evicted from their homes. The situation for some was so dire that they pleaded for assistance from the Labour government, who dismissed them by saying that they had been given tarpaulins for shelter. So this period was aptly termed the days of the pogrom by the Russians. This is an example of a letter which is still in the archives, which is sent to the military authorities by some fuckwit capitalist who runs a sawmill in Newstead. I don't know if comrades can read it from there, but basically it's saying there was a Russian in our employ, we found out he was Russian and we fired him. And of course the military commandant must have been very happy. Within a week of the attack on the Russian club rooms, the Russians' club had been shut, their publication was suppressed, their leadership was awaiting deportation, and other left-wing radicals were sitting in the dock before police magistrate Archdal. Victims not of far-right vigilantes, but of the state eager to carry out their wishes. So the first to face justice was Bykov, who told the court that I am not a criminal, but merely a political prisoner of Australian capitalists. I spent 7 years in the Tsar's dungeons, and I'll be glad to come into prison again for the final victory of the Red Flag. His broken English was greeted with derisory laughter from the onlookers, and he was given 6 months jail. The other defendants were similarly eloquent, though. George Taylor, who was a returned soldier who fought at Gallipoli, declared that he was for international socialism, while Norman Jeffries, the secretary of the One Big Union Propaganda League, welcomed the advent of Bolshevism in Australia. Very heroic in the circumstances. Practically all these defendants were received a 6 months jail in Bogor Road Jail. So despite achieving their demands, which is to crush the left, deport the Russians, the far right continued to mobilise in Brisbane. In April of 1919, they had organised a more explicitly paramilitary force, so with commanding officers organised across the districts in Brisbane, of 2,000 soldiers called the Army to Fight Bolshevism. And this body publicly announced that if any red flags were displayed at the annual May Day March, so the annual demonstration of the Union Movement, there would be blood. While the Union Movement in this circumstance did not risk an open challenge, the far-right orientation of the RSL led to left-wing soldiers forming their own Returned Sailors and Soldiers Labour League, which actually was established at the May Day demonstration. The first meeting of the new soldiers' organisation, with 200 in attendance, passed a motion in support of the plight of the Russians fired from their employment and called on the government to implement a six-hour day in order to free up labour or free up employment for those soldiers who returned from the war. It's also noteworthy that George Taylor, who was a Red Flag prisoner, was elected president of this body after his release in late 1919. This left-wing split in the organisation of the returned soldiers appears to have had quite an impact in weakening the ability of the right to use the soldiers in Queensland as a tool for vigilante violence. So this is, once again, from the Worker newspaper. It might be hard for people to see the writing that they've given every character. So that the woman in the background is the Tory press trying to convince the soldier that it's Labour who are their enemies, while he's saying, you can't really hear it, you can't really see, let me alone, I've got no quarrel with him. These are the fellows I'll have to deal with. His economic enemies, the profiteer and the capitalist. So they're trying to sort of depict what argument that was going on in the workers' movement at this time to convince soldiers to actually side with the unions, which appears to have been somewhat successful. So this period of crisis was capped off by the declaration in July 1919 that the Spanish flu had reached Brisbane. So the Spanish flu killed millions of people around the world at this time, an event which caused further mass demonstrations which prevented further mass demonstrations and set a dampener on what was an explosive atmosphere. But in the aftermath, the Union of Russian Workers was crippled. Those not deported immediately, like Bykov, who was in jail, were rounded up when they were released, and the remnants of the Russian group would merge with the rest of the radical left in 1920 to establish the Communist Party, and Knowledge and Unity would subsequently become the newspaper of that party. The Red Flag riots are instructive about the way that mass far-right organisations have emerged in Australian history. In general, they have arisen with the cooperation of the state apparatus and also thanks to the patronage and organisational networks of the ruling class. Examples of this, what we've seen in this example, were repeated in mob violence in Sydney in 1921 and also, in a different way, in Melbourne during the police strike of 1923. It's also an example of the way far-right ideas emerged as a radicalized version of the prevailing ideology of the mainstream right. So as I showed, the racist scapegoating of the far right was common currency amongst the authorities, and the polarization between the hero soldiers and the disloyal shirker was actually invented by the mainstream. It's worth remembering that what came out of the First World War was this potent mix of racism and authoritarianism as a solution, supposedly, to the increased wartime suffering, which had pushed workers towards questioning the system, and it wasn't any sense of national pride, and it certainly wasn't any increase in freedom. And as for the Labour Party, while they deflected the discontent of the soldiers by helping establish the Soldiers' Labour League, they eagerly took up the opportunity to discipline the left and would not confront the right, even as their actions threatened law and order. While the Labour government and the right wing of the Labour movement had cooperated uneasily with the left when the federal government tried to implement conscription, the Red Flag riots was a clear turning point in their relationship, which indicated Labour's fundamental hostility to the radicals. While the radical left arguably, in my opinion, was mistaken in their decision to march with the Red Flag on the fateful day when they knew they were isolated from the Industrial Council and the Labour Party, clearly the Labour Party and the union officials played a treacherous role. The unions, which had the capacity to push back the right, followed Labour's lead and eschewed any confrontation that could have challenged the right's offensive. The result was a resounding defeat for the left, even while the RSL came away weakened by a split of soldiers who rejected its right-wing politics.